Abroad. K2EIR.
B2JK.
Don, go ahead.
Yeah, I think most of the ARRO handbooks have it, and I know there's a ARRO data book that was out till at one time. I don't know if they still publish that or not. But they have a pictorial of how to strip the, how much of the outer covering has to be stripped back, how much the shield has to be stripped back, and how much the insulation has to be stripped back, and how much the range of the center conductor has to be there. These are the dimensions for the, because this is all for solder type connections with the PL259. I think they also have instructions for connectors, and possibly have been connected in the ARRO handbook. Probably somebody has it better. You can get a copy of that, a couple pages, contagious. I know I usually look at it. Times I do a connection. Back to that, W2JK.
And 2NBR. John?
Also, as a reminder for everyone, always remember you are dealing with dissimilar metals. Okay? So, for example, the pin is quite often silver, and the wire is copper. So it's a dissimilar metal situation, and you eliminate that issue when you solder. Back to you, Gordon.
Yes, absolutely. Good point. Alrighty, anybody else on this topic before we throw it back to Greg? Greg, it's your ball.
Alright, well, thank you. That was fantastic, and as usual, Gordon, you're running a great net here. I just want to comment that I was planning on doing three levels of waterproofing. I was going to do the Scotch Super 33 Plus for sealing it, and the 3M Temflex for UV protection, and then throwing a heat shrink on top of that. So I hope that will make a nice seal for waterproofing. You guys kind of confirmed my thoughts, and that's that when you're going to make a connection, especially of the size of the PL259, that you want to put a couple of dabs of solder on that, at least on the center connector. I'm not sure with the crimps if you put it on that particular portion, because I don't think you can get the metal sleeve to slide back over after you put solder on, but I can look at that, and you know, it's always solder, so you can always play with it and see if you make a good connection. So that's good. So I think I got what I needed, and I definitely appreciate everyone's feedback. Thank you very much. Back to you, Gordon. Get to GFM.
I think your approach is admirable, but I do want to point out that I think right over top of whatever you do in the way of a crimp, you want to put some heat shrink just so that, you know, whatever other goop, junk, and everything else that goes on there, you'll still end up with a finely dressed cable that will be, intrinsically, presentable and sturdy, irrespective of what other outdoor weatherproofing you do. I would just, it doesn't have to go over the ferrule, but it certainly has to go over the shield crimp and onto the body of the coax itself, just to make sure that you don't get water ingress there. And yeah, that's just a good starting point to go with, and I would encourage you to do that, irrespective of what other layers you do. The outer layer of heat shrink that you talked about, I don't know if I'd bother with all that. But certainly the 32 plus and the UV resistant stuff is a good idea. Alrighty, Tony, it's your ball, K2AMI, K2BAR.
Gordon, it's getting late, so I'm going to forfeit my question until the next thing, and it'll give me a chance to do a little more research. I do have some information back that I tried to get in way back when we were talking about licensing. There is a site that will allow you to print out your amateur radio license call sign merely by entering your call. I think if you guys need a copy, I don't know how accepted it'll be by everybody, but apparently from the new regulations, they're not going to be too critical on the paper or the appearance of it. But can I give you this website?
Yeah, do you want to email it to me at my work email, or do you want to just read it off?
It's not difficult. I'll read it off, and if you'd like, I can re-email it to you, but it's www.a7q.com. Then there's a backslash, miscellaneous, M-I-S-C, that's all, M-I-S-C, / generate, but spelled G-E-N-E-R-A-T-E .php. And you can get a copy with watermarks and everything. It looks very official. So if you are concerned about getting a new copy or want to make a copy right away, at this moment you can do that.
Okay, I'm just testing that URL right now. Tony, you said AE7Q.com / in other words, top left, bottom right, which is a little odd, but okay. MISC generate / generate PHP.
The first one should be a forward slash. I'm sorry if I said backslash. It should be miscellaneous / generate .php.
Yeah, AE7Q.com / MISC / generate .php. I'm not getting that to come up, but did someone else?
Negative, did not work, and there's never a backslash in a URL.
You just say E7Q, we'll get you started on it.
Tony, can you cut and paste that URL and email it to w2ttt@att.com, my work email?
Yes, I can do that right now.
I would try it before you send it off, just for grins, but that's certainly interesting.
I've got it on my printer right now, and it looks pretty good. It's as good as the copy that gets from the FCC. It's like it's got watermarks and everything. All right, and again, I'll repeat, maybe it's lowercase. Would that make a difference? I got lowercase .AE7Q. Does that make a difference?
No, go ahead.
Lowercase AE7Q.com / MISC .. generate .php.
Enter JDH.
Go ahead.
The problem is if you don't put that G as a capital, it won't bring you to the page. You have to put the capital G in there for generate. Back to net.
How about that?
That's nasty.
Yeah, but I got it. And I must say, it looks so pretty. Takes my official FCC data and makes it look pretty different. Why does it say reference copy not valid for identification at the bottom?
Hell, I don't know. But it's a good copy.
No, I wouldn't use this. It says this is not an official FCC license. It is a record of public information contained in the FCC's licensing database on the date this reference copy was generated. In case of FCC rules require a presentation, posting, or display of an FCC license, this document may not be used in place of the official FCC license. I think you have to print it off the FCC website. I think that's what it's telling you.
Well, it's your option.
It is darn pretty, though, Tony. But it says in big red ink, right under your license signature, don't do this. So, I don't know. Alrighty. I suspect that over the next couple of weeks, this guy may actually drop that, but one never knows. It's certainly good to keep handy. Thank you. Anything else, Tony?
Negative for this week. We'll get you next week.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and gosh, it does look pretty. I'll give him that. All right. Let's see. Our next... WHUMP, Jim.
Yeah, good evening, Gordon. And this is a little bit related to what we were talking about with coax and connectors. I'm about to put up an antenna in my attic, a five-element Yagi UHF, about to run the coax. I'm going to order some LMR 240, and I was wondering where is a good place to order that. If somebody has some ideas, I see some ads on eBay, and I'm a little bit leery that you know that it won't be shipped, handled, or meet spec. So I wonder if anybody has some good connections for coax like LMR 240. Back to net.
Comment. Mr. Randy.
I've ordered successfully from Davis RF. I think that's also known as Orion Wire. Give them a phone call. It's your best bet if you've never ordered from them before. Extremely helpful people, very reliable, and top quality goods. Back to net.
That's a good reference.
Davis RF, that's easy enough to Google. And the question is, what type of connectors to order? I was intrigued by the conversation. I've never crimped before. I just always took it for granted that you solder coaxial connectors. Any thoughts about what's best to order?
Ed Randy.
Jim, I have a preference for the crimp connectors, and the Davis RF people can help you with that. I would ask them directly what they recommend, but they're only going to sell top quality connectors, which are tend to be a little bit more expensive, not significantly in my mind. If you decide to get the crimp connectors, if you like, you don't need to purchase the expensive crimping tool. I would be more than happy to lend you my crimping and coax stripping tools, which are set up for the Times microwave coax in both sizes. Another good source for connectors is Max Gain Systems down in Georgia. I forget the town. I think it's Conyers, Georgia. Fellow name of Alan Bond. Again, extremely reliable, high quality, a great selection of connectors. Back to net.
All right, very good. So that's Max Gain Systems for possible source of connectors. Very good. I'll Google and take a look.
Randy, Max Gain Systems is one. And what was the other gentleman's name?
Max Gain Systems, I don't think he lists his name on the site, but it's Alan, A-L-A-N, Bond, B-O-N-D, and it's on the shipping label when he confirms your order and sends your order to you.
A-L-A-N, Bond.
Correct.
Okay, very good. I made a note of that in the notes for tonight as well. Good. Thank you, Randy. Alrighty, anything else from you, Jim?
Nope, sounds good. A simple question. I'm looking forward to putting up this Yagi in the attic, and with that I'll be able to work the world.
Comment?
Good, comment.
Okay, hey, to the AR on the group, WA6WC. A lot of us have crimpers. If you come down to Kitnight some night, or give us a little warning, any number of us could bring crimpers on down. Also, the connectors you see on eBay that look really cheap, they tend to be much thinner material, much thinner barrel. I'm partial to the Teflon-style insulators. There's also some Chinese stuff that isn't Teflon. It looks Teflon-ish, but it's a plastic, and it doesn't hold up as well to heat, particularly if you're doing soldering.
Let me also point out, you do not want to use anything that's not Teflon if you can get if you have a choice.
All right, well, good point. I would be inclined to purchase a knockoff crimper, though. Are there any problems with that?
Want the crimper that matches the connectors you're crimping for the coax you want to crimp. You do not want to play that game.
All right, I will look into it. Thank you.
I mean, if you're comfortable with some of the Asian stuff, hey, that's great. It's not one area I would go do that, personally. I'm a big fan of buying from the People's Liberation Army for a number of things. This would not be one of them. But more importantly, wherever I get my connectors from, that is where I'm buying my crimp tool. Someone? Who was that?
It's Bruce again. The PL-259s are going to be solder on the sender always. Ends can be solder or crimp depending on the type of end connector you get on the center pin. Both PL-259 and ends can be crimped on the outside. There's even West Mountain Radio has crimper tools and sets of dies. The center pin takes a particular crimp size, and it varies by the connector and manufacturer you get. And the outside ferrule, same thing.
All right, very good. I may take a look. I'm used to soldering PL-259 connectors. That's what I've always done. Of course, I've done most of my work in the earlier days in HF when this was less critical. But as far as using a crimping tool, I may take a look on YouTube and see what's available and how it's done.
Why don't you come down to Kit Night sometime? Give us a little bit of warning. We can bring some tools over. You can see how it's done.
All right, sounds like a plan.
Unfortunately, I'm one of the only guys who's eligible to come to check the Kit Night who can't almost ever because of the Boy Scout troop meeting. But there's a ready cadre of guys who will more than happily help you out, Jim. And I would encourage you to take them up on their offer.
All right. Sounds good, guys. Thanks for the advice.
Okay. Very good. Very good. All righty. Randy, W2S, K2BAR.
Thank you. Good evening to everyone on the net. Just a very brief note here of some interest to those of you who are really interested in electronics and building, that sort of thing, understanding how circuits work. The very famous book, Art of Electronics, by Horowitz and Hill, is coming out in a third edition in a couple of months. It's due to be published on April 30th, and this third edition has 300 more pages than the second edition. It's completely revised, and it's something to look forward to. If you've got a birthday or a special anniversary coming up, maybe you can get somebody to buy it for you, because it is not cheap, but then quality never is. I believe it's $108 on Amazon for pre-order, and I just thought those of you that remember Horowitz and Hill fondly will look forward to this new publication. Back to net.
Do we have the title again, please?
It's the title is The Art of Electronics, or just Art of Electronics, two authors, Horowitz and Hill.
Okay. Available on Amazon via pre-order.
N1STU, disconnected, connected, KC2NPZ, connected, N2BHZ, repeater, connected, KC2NPZ.
Okie dokie. All right, I'm going to take this in order. Just make sure I have it right before we go on. N2VHZ, are you on, and do you have a question for the net, Mr. or comment or anything else, Mr. Ken? Okay, he's probably away from his radio because he connects his repeater out in Nebraska, western Nebraska, where it's very rural. Alrighty, was there another station on Echo Link that wants to come in?
disconnected.
Okay. I heard STU and TZ. All right, well, all right, very good. We're right along. Randy, thank you very much. Did you want to add anything else?
Nothing more, thank you.
All right, very good. I have put that in the notes. And let's see. WITW, Steve, your ball, K2BAR.
K2BAR, WITW. Well, just my comment is that over the weekend I had a lot of fun in the ARRL January VHF contest, which I worked from home, which was kind of interesting. I've never done that before. I made about 112 contacts. I didn't operate the full contest. The interesting thing was I really don't have any antennas that were designed for that kind of activity. For 6 meters, I used my HF beam, which is a Force 12 C3SS. It takes power on 6 meters with my tuner, and it is somewhat directional, so made a bunch of contacts with that. And for 2 meters and 432 sideband and CW and 222 FM, I used a vertical FM antenna that's relatively close to the ground. The base of the antenna is right at the gutter line of the roof, and the top of it does not extend over the roof. And amazingly had an incredible amount of fun, a lot more fun than I did chasing EP6T, the Iranian de-expedition, which I did not work. Got frustrated with that and said the heck with it, and had a ball in the contest. So next year I can see myself with a much better antenna system for even more fun. And that's it. K2BAR, WI2W.
So you used an HF dipole on 6 meters and a omni vertical on 144 and 432. Did I get that right?
Well, I used an HF tribander. It's a Force 12 C3SS tribander, 10, 15, and 20 at about 45 feet. And that took power on 6 meters. It doesn't have any traps in it. It's linearly loaded on 20 and full size on 10 and 15. With a one-to-one balance at the feed point. And it took power, and it was directional. So, and then I used an FM vertical for 2 meters and 432 sideband, and I also had a 222 FM rig on that antenna as well. So, amazing I made contacts at all.
Yep, very good. If I hadn't had, you know, all this coughing and nonsense, I would have been on, but it just wasn't up for the game, and that's great. That's super. Anybody else have any comments about that? Well, that's great, Steve, and hope to join you in that effort next year. I have substantially better antennas on 6 and 2, and could have even more without too much trouble, so good for you, and it's a lot of fun. Four bands, including one that was solely FM. That's pretty awesome. It's very, very awesome. Alrighty. I think we'll move to Ray, W2CH, K2BAR.
Yes, K2BAR in the net, W2CH. Okay, Gordon. Not too much. Just wanted to comment again on the radio I received today to have a second HT for a reasonable price, a Beofunk, and an unusual model, BF-F9V2+. It seems to be about the third generation of the UV5R after the UVA2. I think there's another similar model too. The big point is that for its price, in the about $65 range, it came with 3,800 milliamp hour battery that does make it bigger, with the usual accessories, and it's dual band and 8 watts on 2 meters. So, on the, it's a bit less on UHF. And while I received it today and have not worked too much with it, I'm waiting for the programming information and cable on a separate order. I thought it was interesting, and people weren't aware of this type of model I found on Amazon that came very quickly, U.S. mail. So, K2BAR, W2CH.
Very good, Ray. I took note of that. Could you slowly give us the model? It's Bravo, Foxtrot, what now?
Yes, it's Bravo, Foxtrot, dash, F as in Foxtrot again, 9, V as in Victor, 2, and then the plus sign. There is a similar model from them also that is something with an 8. If you go to Amazon and look up Baofeng, you'll see usually the UV5 for around $30-some. This model with the standard battery for about $55, and the other model too. And then one vendor was selling it with the larger battery for about $10 more. Plus shipping, it was about $70, another $5 shipping. And came very quickly through the seller from Amazon. So I just thought it might be interest. I've only seen a higher power Reese HT in the British magazine, some other dealer of one that was 8 watts over in the UK. That's some, I hope, helpful information. And it can be pretty easily found, that you can look for dealers. Or what it does is Amazon will link with somebody, and that's how I found it.
Yeah, the one that is the F8, whatever that is, N2OEL had bought when he was convalescing after his surgery. He wanted a beefier radio to get out of the rehab facility he was in, and that worked out real well for him. So these are really good. Now, I have a request to do. Can you dial up 442 and .000 and let me know whether or not you hear a self-induced internal birdie? Because that is one thing we would like to know immediately.
Okay, K2BAR and then that W2CH. Yes, I've noticed that on one of the radios I had or something, on 442, there's like a carrier or a birdie, which I noticed. Now, I'll check this quickly for a second. I'll turn it on if you want to talk about that a second. But that seems to have been a symptom with another import radio, Chinese. I had a BAOJIE. 55, which I sold off at an auction. Nothing really bad with it, but instead of this mobile, and now have MyCom for a good bit more, it also had that on 442.
Well, there are a number of us who would like to know if there's, you know, Biafeng Radio doesn't have it. That would be awesome. By the way, I have one of the Gushan HTs, the original KG UVD1P, and it's in a weird state. I cannot change its frequency. I cannot do any direct entry on the keypad. It will not take any commands on the serial port, on the computer port. And the good news is it works on 146.955 because that's where it was last, but I can't unlock the keyboard. I can't do anything. It's very frustrating. And I'm wondering if anyone has any ideas on how to, shall we say, unlock a stuck, or if you will, re-zero set to defaults, an Ushan or a Waxon KG UVD 1P. I'd be very curious while we're waiting if anyone knows how to fix that.
W2CH with a comment on that and a suggestion other than the reset of somebody you might talk to?
Sure. And if someone knows what the magic key
combinations are to flatten it, that would be, you know, like a power on, hold these keys, you know, pat your belly and rub your belly and pat your head kind of a thing. I'd love to know that too, Ray. Go ahead.
Well, it's just a suggestion that Power Works, which seems to be a big seller of Wushan, they out in the west coast, that's near California, I had my KG UBAD from HRO, but they were the provider of it, I guess, back in 6 months ago or so, back in August when it came out, and I had some problems, and they sent me another one that, except for shipping from here, that had a later firmware, and I thought since they maybe carried it, you could talk to the technical department. There's a fellow named Martin. I don't remember the rest of the name. I'd have to look at my files on that, on the KGUVAD, which is my other HD, which no problem since then, but that's just a comment.
That's helpful. So what was the verdict on 442?
Well, so far I hear nothing. I'm on 442 and there's no birdie so far. I'm just on the internal antenna, but that shouldn't make any difference since it's, you know, I mean a whip antenna since it would be internal to the processor.
Okay. Interesting. You know what? If you have the radio powered on, let me just quickly key up 442 and see if you hear it. W2TTT testing. Maybe that will be answer your question.
Yes, I'm on it. Just it's moderately strong here. I think it's in waneness, I believe, but did not hear anything but your signal.
Well, that's good to know. All right. That's very, very good. By the way, if I hold the three key down, as sometimes you do, it just comes up with the model number. It doesn't reset the radio on the KGUVD1P. But all right, well, very good. Anybody have any questions to Ray about this radio or similar radio? All right, Ray. Whoops, sorry about that. By the way, during the entire net, I've been doing a 2-meter band sweep, and Lord knows, I've been running low power here, but I've been running a spectrum analyzer the whole time, and very slow sweeping waterfall. Maybe it takes a couple of seconds to sweep the 2-meter band, but it's been very, very useful. About 5-second sweeps, I guess, but maybe a little longer. And very interesting when I transmit versus when I don't as to what other artifacts show up in the band. I think that's because I've overloaded the instrument, but interesting nonetheless. This is with my little RF Explorer handheld spectrum analyzer. It's just good to 2.7 gigs and has a Wi-Fi mode. And I've been using a couple of different add-on packages, Touchstone Pro, which is gives you some sort of recording and other capabilities. It also gives you discrete channel monitoring if you want to do that, which is kind of handy. It's also I've been using Net Surveyor, which is a wonderful program for looking at Wi-Fi. And a couple other analytical programs for various spectrum. Let's say you're looking at 900 megs and you want to have something that's a little more persistent than just what's in your hand. You can tether this thing to a small laptop and sweep an area pretty coherently and come up with histograms and 3D histograms and other such fun things. So, good stuff all around. Anyway, anybody else have any questions, comments, confusions?
And 2JH with a question.
Go
go right ahead.
K2KR into JDH. I know you were saying previously about your radio, and I had the Bowfang 5R, and I went to go write the program. It got hung up with the old frequency, but DA got to the point where I had to pretty much load a blank program as if it was a factory reset. Something else would work. I had to write zero, so all the frequencies, and program the radio with that, program it with the frequency plug that I had on it, and it worked. I'm not sure if that will help with that radio, but that's something you probably should try.
Unfortunately, Andre, the serial interface doesn't work. Well, it may. I've just cleaned up another laptop, which should help us. So I had a problem with a laptop before on serial ports, so this may be better. So let me just not say it won't work, but I thought there might be a default way to scratch this and get it back to factory defaults. I do want to make another comment about the RF Explorer Spectrum Analyzer. It's about $260, which is pretty darn wonderful, and you know, it'll work everywhere from, you know, about 10 megahertz up to about 2700 megahertz. So I strongly advise it. It's certainly not a free counter, but it's, it gives you the stuff in the ballpark, and tethered with a USB cable, you can certainly get a lot of information about what's going on in the bands. You want to monitor the local repeaters and find out how much activity they have and at what time of day. You can actually do that, which is kind of neat. So I encourage people to think about RF Explorer. It's available from Nuts About Nets, and they have a pretty good website. All their support is online, and I think the only glitch I had on it that really was remarkable was they shipped a semi-defective USB cable with it, which was kind of odd, but that caused me some fits, but replacing the USB cable made the problem go away. The other thing I wanted to point out, let me drop it. The other day I had the pleasure of picking up some solar panels that were meant for household AC grid tie type systems, and these are nominally 30 volt solar panels. And today I received in the mail, or actually via UPS from the People's Republic of China, a controller that was about $60, and it allowed me to take that higher voltage solar panel and connect it to a 12-volt battery, in this case a large sealed lead acid, charge it, and also then to monitor the current consumption, and also current supply. It has lots of telemetry. Unfortunately, it's via display, but they do make a higher, more expensive version that has you know, a control interface that you can actually use to monitor via computer your power usage. But everything you'd want to know, ampere hours, you know, cumulative amps going into the battery, cumulative amps coming from the solar panel, cumulative amps consumed by the load, things like that are all provided, and very, very economically. It's only a 30-amp charger, so you probably can only put a couple of these panels on it, but it's, you know, for the price, it was very reasonable. And these panels are 39 inches by 60 inches, so they're not small panels, but they are 220-watt panels. And they can be had for about $150. There's a local guy here who's selling them. They're meant from Schott Solar. If you look at Schott Solar, S-C-H-O-T-T, the 220-watt variety, and I can point you to the source if anyone's interested. pretty cool stuff. But we're very happy with it, and I wired it up tonight and got some light on the panel and proved the point that it works. So when the snow stops flying, I'll be able to mount a couple of these on my trailer and go from there. But probably get another one of these controllers for the house and put a couple of more panels in over here. I've got two or three panels. Well, I have three panels now. But I suspect if you had 400 watts of power that you're dumping into a deep battery bank, that's pretty reasonable. And your total outlay, your cost outlay, is not too horrendous. You can run a lot of things from not much stored power. So, any questions, comments, confusions about the solar work? Alrighty. Any other comments, questions, confusions about the net in general?
A2EIR.
Go ahead, Howie.
May have missed this because I haven't been here for a while. But you were going to Annapolis and you were going to talk with WB4APF, whatever his call is. How'd that go?
Good question. Bob Reninga was not there. However, his lab was made available, his satellite lab. The midshipman had full access to it, and a second class midshipman had keys to the lab and made good use of it. And in fact, I helped him quite a bit. He had gotten some tutorial information from Bob the night before on how to run the lab and how to run the satellite portion, in particular satellite tracking and such, and had to help him along with that. But he wasn't a ham, but very good stuff, and I know my way on that lab pretty well, having been there a few years. So unfortunately I did not see Bob, but did see the product of his labors. And you know, it's really good when midshipmen can go and execute a program in a fairly elaborate lab without shall we say management supervision, and run a great program. They actually ran three different merit badges through that lab. They ran a STEM specific program, and they also ran a program of radio and another of electronics, and all got to the STEM folks camped out in there, and then the others were visitors for about a half hour at a time, both morning and afternoon sessions. So it was really good. Really, really was. K2AR, K2BAR.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I would have been interested in Bob Brewing's remarks, especially if you mentioned the solar power stuff. By the way, congratulations on that. It sounds nice. Again, if I was more daring, inviting the board here and all that, I think I'd buy some of those panels and maybe that controller too, because I could use an inverter and use it with as a grid tie system, and I could switch over to battery backup when the AC system went down. As you know, most of these inverters for grid tie, as a safety feature, disconnect you from the power lines and will not generate when power is down. But of course, sometimes you want to run things with an inverter, for example, and run AC devices in your home when power is out. The ways you do that safely. Certainly, if it's an independent system, you have appliances attached directly to an inverter, you're in no danger, or certainly not the kind of dangers that you would have if you were trying to use your household wiring. K2EIR.
Yeah, Howie. Well, I personally am not a big fan of grid tie. It has its place. If I'm going to go through the trouble of having solar panels, then I want some sort of autonomy from the power grid should they, thing come to its knees. I think that's kind of important. Having said that, these panels are pretty large, they're pretty neat. 220 watts is a lot of power. They're really, really nice, and they have polycrystalline chemistry, so they're capable of delivering some power in really crappy light, which is good. One thing I should point out is that I chose to use a PWM controller, a pulse width modulation controller, which are not the most efficient in the world, but they're adequate for the purpose. And since I had an abundance of power to burn, number one, and number two, I had budget to consider. A 30 amp charge controller that would accommodate, these higher voltage, nominally 30, 36, up to 40 some odd volts. The controller will actually handle up to 50 volts and charge a 12 volt battery, which is kind of cool, and dumps 30 amps at 12 volts, by the way. So that's pretty impressive in itself. So with that in mind, you have to think what kind of battery array would you want for that. So there's something to think about there too. I have a limited set of batteries, but you'd want something that's designed for deep cycle, high capacity, et cetera, et cetera. And you want to find them when they're still workable, but at the end of their, shall we say, mandated service life from their primary use. You probably get another 10 or 20 years out of them if you treat them right. Very often, after 5 to 7, 8 years, a lot of battery backup arrays have to be replaced in order to make sure that they meet insurance or regulatory requirements. So that's what that's about. Right now I have 150 ampere hour deep cycle. I have another 110 or 20 amp deep cycle. They're not of a different chemistry, a different size. So I'm going to have to think about that a little bit. There are more efficient controllers called MPPT controllers, Mike Papa Papa Tango. And they are much more expensive. That's why you see controllers in the sub-$100 range, and you see controllers in the $400 to $600 range. And that's pretty much why. So do consider that as part of your choices, as they say. Let's see, what else did I want to mention? I'll drop it here just in case someone else wants to make a comment.
K2EIR. I think that's maximum power point transfer or something like that. It's just the same also with inverters. You can get pure sine wave or, something that simulates it, but it's really square wave. K2EIR.
Yes, exactly. Maximum power point transfer. Thank you. They're marvelous. And I think if I had a large array of them here and I had a huge battery backup capability here, then I would give great consideration to an MPP controller because, you're running, let's say, 6, 8 or more panels at 200 watts apiece. Well, hell's bells, you want to maximize that transfer and also get some good use out of it. At that point, in my past, I've had, 1,400, 1,500, 1,600, actually as much as 1,900 ampere hours of a battery. I'm thinking maybe more, actually. 1, 2, 3. I guess about that. About 1,900 ampere hours at 13.2 volts. using 2-cell 4.4-volt batteries in rows of three or columns of three. I had lots of them at one time. But that was a long time ago, and before my days of solar, I actually used to float charge them. And when we'd lose power, I had an abundance of battery. But other than annoying my neighbor, because they didn't understand what they saw, but it was aesthetically clean as a whistle, they got the building inspector all involved, and after about 5 minutes, the building inspector said, I don't have a quarrel here. Have a nice day. And he walked away. Which I thought was very entertaining. That was probably 20 years ago. I would think an MPPT controller would be good and be justified if I had, you know, 6, 8 or more panels, because at that point at $100-some-odd a panel, which is incredibly cheap because you can pay that much in shipping and much more for the panels themselves, it's a good deal. So it is something to think about over time, but the first two panels are going on my trailer and with a small portable battery array and some other things. So that's the spring project, and it's the steel is already here, the clamps are already here for the frame to mount it and to do some other things I want to put on the trailer. So it's all good. Anybody else?
Question, Gordon. How did you get these panels? I know it was offered on Craigslist. Did you pick them up yourself?
My intention was to shove them into the back of my car, which I could have done. It would have been a little awkward because of my interesting antenna mount that I have on my hitch. But fortunately, Rick, W2LCN, came along just to eyeball them. He was interested. And so that night we threw three of them in this pickup truck. It was a Thursday night. And the next night I dragged my trailer down to the Trail on Radio Club, and we transferred them from his truck to my trailer, and away we go.
Okay, well, that gets the shipping down. Yeah, I think it's a bit fine. I should stop break-chewing with you and this doing that. K2EIR.
Yeah, we are over 2 hours on the net tonight, which is kind of amazing. But we did get every topic in except for Tony's question. He got his topic in, but it's not his question, so I kind of feel bad about that. But we were running a little long. But he gets very excited. A good reason. Everybody gets very, very excited over things like, what do you mean I don't get a printed amateur radio license? I can understand that. Oh, I have a question for you that might be helpful. I'm getting this Microsoft Shield overlaying some applications I recently installed under Windows 8, but I've seen it under Windows 7 and even XP. It's that blue and yellow, you know, Shield. I think you've probably seen it. What does that mean? Because the application is performing fine, but it's very disconcerting to see that.
Well, to me, I'm not sure. I don't really. I haven't upgraded. I haven't done anything in a long time. I'm so obsolete. But they do have something which is on XP and probably parallel, whether you have things like automatic updates on or off, whether you have a virus, antivirus protection on or off, and that's what that symbol is, if I'm thinking the same one. So they're just trying to tell you, are you protected or not, and there could be three or four or more options under that.
Okay. That could be. Lord only knows, but that could be. Anybody else have any thoughts?
AE2KB.
AE2KB, K2BAR.
K2BAR, this is Kilo Echo 2 Kilo Bravo. Name is Frank. I'm a TNEC. Blue and yellow shield, I believe, is the administrator shield. It means the program's running under administrator privileges.
Oh, okay. Well, that works for me.
Not sure about Windows 8. I'm running Windows 7.
Yeah, I've seen similar things under Windows 7. So it means it's under administrator privileges that it has to be run. I think the only login I have on this machine is set up as administrator, so I guess that means it's okay.
I don't know if it means it has to be run that way or if it is being run. I'm not really sure, but I see it on some applications where I have the compatibility set up to run as administrator.
Interesting. Alrighty. I will keep that in mind. Thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate that. Yeah, this is on the shortcut, actually. So it's a little disconcerting, but it's all right. I just finished and recorded and saved my Touchstone Pro, spectrograms for the TechNet, and then messing around with some other applications now. But it is kind of neat. This little RF Explorer RF head is. I mean, it's not the fastest thing in the world, and God knows USB 2 is not exactly, super quick. But, you know, for a lot of things, it's just fine.
This is KE2KB with a further confirmation of that comment.
Sure.
On Microsoft.com's question and answer page here, it does say that is the case where the... blue and yellow shield means that items need to be run with administrator privileges.
Okay. Very good. Well, now we learn, now we know.
I find that kind of annoying, actually. I don't like to log in as administrator for the security on the web, but I don't like these applications that require administrator privileges to run. But I guess if they're going to modify program files, then they have to be. That's the only reason I can imagine that anything would have to be run as administrator, unless you're actually doing changes to the program. You shouldn't even need it. All right. This is KE2KB.
Very good. Very good. Let's see. Anything you wanted to add, Mr. Howie?
Not relevant to the net, but I thought I'd mention to you that I did have that knee surgery, a torn meniscus repair. They drilled two holes into my knee, and I am recovering now fairly nicely. I just discovered today that one of the painkillers I was given, I was only taking half a dose. I was supposed to take two tablets every morning after breakfast, and I was only taking one. Wondering why I'm still feeling pain. Hi.
Don't you hate that? All right, well, let me just close up the net here. We can continue if you want for a couple of minutes. I want to thank the Chestnut Ridge Radio Clip for the use of their repeater, and thank all of you guys for your contributions tonight. Quite a lively net tonight, to say the least. And I'm being reminded by my wife that I should pull in my car so that we don't have any issues with the local constabulary overnight. So anyway... I want to thank everybody for their participation and remind everybody we'll see some of you at the Fairlawn Radio Club tomorrow night. Anytime after, I think, 6 or 7. I think 6 tomorrow night is the plan. And look forward to that. And God bless and be safe in the upcoming snow. This is K2BAR, W2TTT, returning the repeater to normal amateur radio use. So, Mr. Howie, regarding your knee... besides the pain, how are you getting about?
Pretty well now. The part of the instructions not to use my cane after a while, and like the second day or something like that, and I found it was fine. Today, early part of the day, I was because I was running around shopping and just on my feet a lot, straining and whatever. There were a couple of times I wished I did have my cane, but for the most part I'm all right. Sometimes I'm limping. I had all these post-op instructions, exercises to do, etc. And what happened was I really overdid it by clearing snow, shoveling snow, and didn't get time. I was exhausted with all the things, trying to get food before or after the snowstorm and those kinds of things. I didn't have time to if you can